Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 133rd edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During this show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is Bob Ando. He's the third of eight children in his family and was born in Accra, Ghana. His family valued education, and all the children earned at least bachelor's degrees. Bob has his PhD in public health engineering and has a career's worth of experience as an environmental engineer, working in 23 countries on water projects. He is the husband of Janet Ando, who was on the show just a few weeks ago, and they have a lovely adult daughter together and live in South Portland, Maine. Welcome to New Mainers Speak, Bob.
Thank you, Kate.
I wondered if we could start by having you tell us about your Ghana of your childhood, the Ghana of your memories and your dreams. You lived in Accra and Kumasi, which are the two largest cities. And I'm just curious what they looked like, felt like in the 60s when it was a brand new country.
Right, okay. In terms of early childhood experiences and impressions, I don't really remember much regarding the independence itself, because independence, I was too young. I was probably right about one. However, in terms of childhood memories, they include being part of a large family, including siblings and cousins, and having a lot of fun playing outdoors. Indoors, we played games such as hide and seek, and particularly in the evenings, these were storytelling times. We have something called Anansi stories, and there are ways in which the older generation pass on moral.
Is that Spider Anansi?
Spider Anansi,
oh,
yes.
Oh, I love those.
Right, yes.
Little
yes.
Wise tales for children mm-hmm. to understand mm-hmm. the world in new ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lovely.
And in terms of smells, they included foods like jollof rice coming from the kitchen. My favorite food was rice. And I was nicknamed Chinese because of the amount of rice that I ate.
Who was telling the Spider Anansi stories?
It was my mom and my aunties, and we had like an extended family system, which included house help. And the older ones would typically tell the stories to us, the kids.
And how many people do you think were living in your house at any given time with extended family?
At any given time, it could be maybe 12 people, all said and done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe 8 to 12, depending on the season, the time. Typically, when you got to Easter and Christmas, you had a lot more people than sort of during the normal sort of times.
Yeah, people would come to town to celebrate with family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. In terms of memories also, I remember very vividly the day of the coup, which was in the 60s, that overthrew Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana, and the jubilation that ensued. Because that singular event was a cause of major change in our lives. As our dad was part of the Constituent Assembly that wrote the new constitution, and afterwards we moved from Accra to Kumasi, where he took up a new appointment as the registrar of the University of Science and Technology, a relatively new university focused on engineering and the sciences.
Yeah, so Ghana had a hopeful spirit, and they were coming alive, coming together. They were young, and they built a university, and your dad was the registrar.
Yes, that's the registrar university at Kumasi. And that change, move from Accra to Kumasi, was a major change for us, because I was about 9 years old then. And though excited, as I enjoyed traveling and vacationing, especially road trips we took to visit our dad's best friends around Christmas and Easter, this was a complete change in environment, leaving our friends behind and having to make a new start and a fresh set of friends on the campus that had a very different feel and vibe. Because in essence, Kumasi was a science and technology university. Legon, which was in Accra, was more of a liberal arts type university. So
I see.
It was a complete change for us.
I have to say, I didn't know Kumasi, and I went online and looked, and it's a very densely populated city.
Yeah, about a population of about almost 2 million now. But in those days, probably it was about a million. It's grown very fast, being the second largest city in Ghana.
Were you allowed to run around as kids in the city?
Well, where we lived was a campus, which is sort of not in the center of the city. It was on the outskirts. It was a very open environment, so we played outdoors quite a bit.
Mm.
But in terms of some of the memories around that time, I remember being academically very challenged because, in effect, in Legon, the school I went to was from class 1 to 7, and the school in Kumasi was from class 1 to 6. So the transition from Accra to Kumasi meant I jumped a year. So I had to have a lot of private tuition and so on and so forth to sort of to be able to catch up.
Yeah, it didn't hold you back too much, though.
It didn't. It probably advantaged me because, in a sense, my elder brother is about 3 years older than me. But that change caused the gap to reduce to 2 years because, essentially, I went 1 year ahead.
Are your elder brothers twins?
No, the younger ones are twins. My elder brother is not a twin. We have only one set of twins within our family.
Is it true that in parts of Africa, twins mean a special connection, like kind of a special psychic connection?
Yes, that's very true. But also, in terms of just the twins in our family, my observation is that they have a special connection, you know. When one is sick, the other feels it, you know, and stuff like that. You know, they were identical twins, and they're really pretty much inseparable. But now, in their older days, they are separate. One is in the UK, and one is in the US. But they're very much in touch with each other on a very regular basis.
Yes, I had a roommate in college who had a twin, and back when we used real telephones with cords and things like that, she'd walk to the phone, pick it up to call her sister. It hadn't even rung, and her sister would be calling her and just be there.
They just knew.
Frequently.
Yeah, they just knew. Yeah.
Yeah, so your family lived on this college campus because of your father's post as the registrar, and it was a brand new university there. And your mother was the headmistress of a school and later built her own school. And I wonder what that was like for you. How do you think that life with so much university and schooling and value on education affected your views of yourself as an academic learner and your siblings who've all gone on to reach pretty high heights?
Yes, our parents were very keen on education and kept stressing to us the importance of education. Also, the fact that my elder brother had sort of passed his common entrance and been admitted to one of the best schools set a pace for the rest of us, with no one wanting to let the side down. So in that sense, obviously, he went ahead, and then I followed, and the other siblings sort of also followed suit.
Yeah, so he was a real pace setter.
He was a pace setter. He was really a pace setter. And it was a very good thing for me personally that I ended up in the same secondary school as he did. Because when I went to school, secondary school, which is like high school, I was very young. I was about 11 years. And in Ghana, back in Ghana, the secondary schooling is boarding. So you go away from home and you stay in a boarding house. And I was very immature, but he sort of essentially took care of me. He made sure that I planned my lesson notes and stuff like that. And, you know, because I was very playful, I'd go and play in the soccer pitch or whatever, and then he'd come and call me, pull me by my neck, and then take me to the classroom and say, hey, sit down, you got to do your homework, you got to do this and that, and so on. So that really, really helped me.
What did he become?
He is a structural engineer, and he lives here in the U.S., in Atlanta. He has his own little practice as well as he works full-time as a structural engineer.
Does he ever grab you by the neck anymore and make you do stuff?
give it a chance, he would like to do that. But
yeah, and you mentioned to me that your siblings are physician, structural engineer, architect. Did you say police officer?
No, there's one that's a valuer, an estate agent kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
He's based in the UK. And then obviously there's a financial analyst as well. And then a medical doctor.
Wow. You said that you knew you wanted to be an engineer as a boy because of the way you liked to build things. You were also a big reader then? Did you like to read?
I liked to read. Most of what I read were comic books.
Uh-huh.
Did you have
a favorite?
I had a favorite. My favorite character was actually Hulk.
The Hulk?
The Hulk. I don't know whether because he had an alter ego or what, but I like characters such as, we read a lot of the Marvel comics, so Beano, Spider-Man, Superman, etc. And also there was the Tintin series that we read a lot.
Sure. And how did you find your way to having a passion for water? You've been studying and working in water and engineering, environmental engineering around water your whole life. And how did that come to be part of your world?
Well, in my third year civil engineering degree course at the university, we had a module called environmental quality engineering, which was taught by an Indian professor. And he really brought that subject to life. And that awakened my passion for water. And ever since then, I've realized that that's the area that I've got to be in. I did my project work for my degree course in water, and then did my postgraduate PhD also in water. And ever since, my career has been along the lines of water. Even at times when I've had an opportunity to switch away because of the potential for earning a lot more, I've always come back to water.
Water is so, it's almost spiritual in its fundamental character in all of our lives. Everyone needs clean water.
I've come to the realization that water really is life.
Yeah, I can see how you'd be attracted to it, almost like a calling.
It is a calling, for me anyway, particularly realizing that there are billions of people on the planet that don't have access to clean water or sanitary facilities. To me, that is something that's deplorable, that we need to do everything we can to address those challenges. And that's the area.
Yeah, clean water is a human right.
It is a human right.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You are listening to New Mainers Speak. My guest today is Bob Ando, and he was born and educated in Ghana, where he lived for 23 years, before moving to London, England, to continue his studies in public health engineering, where he worked for 23 years, prior to moving to Maine for his work in 2003. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your life, the way you consider yourself a global citizen, Bob.
Well, in terms of being a global citizen, I'd like to start with my first real exposure to what I call foreign lands. And that started by traveling outside Ghana to the UK for my postgraduate studies at Imperial College. And obviously, though I had been exposed to some extent to Western culture from training, education, and reading books, etc., this had not prepared me for the cultural shocks I would experience. Because, for example, in Ghana, you would automatically have conversations with somebody sitting next to you on a train journey. Now I go to the UK, and on the tubes are the underground railway or the metro, you had people keeping to themselves, reading newspapers, and hardly interacting with each other. This I found quite weird and strange.
Yeah, that is weird and strange, isn't it? When you're used to connecting with other humans.
Yeah, precisely. And talking about exposure, throughout my adult life, I've been on a quest to understand better the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. And in the process, I've tried to, what I call, deprogram myself from prior notions and belief systems, kept an open mind, read widely, and tried to reconstruct the meaning of life as it appealed to me from an inner core sense level, call it my search for truth. And my world travels to some 21 countries or so has brought me in contact with people from different backgrounds and cultures. Mind you, I was a pretty introverted person until after my PhD days, and I couldn't find a job in my profession as a civil engineer, and I had to drive a taxi in London to make ends meet. Obviously, as a London taxi driver, you get to be exposed to lots of different people types. You also learn very quickly the benefits that accrue from being nice to people in the form of decent tips. And one thing I learned from all that exposure is the commonality that exists in the human race. In essence, we are all one people with similar dreams and aspirations, albeit coming alive from diverse cultural and societal backgrounds and experiences. But more importantly, we are all children of one reality, that is God.
Yeah, so I imagine you've had to check your belief systems over and over, working in 20-something countries. Things you just assumed everybody did, they don't do there.
Mm-hmm.
Or things everybody had, these people don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we all have in common? That's your quest for truth.
That's right.
It's our humanity.
Yes. And in a sense, I've come to the conclusion that there are three basic human attributes that need to be in balance. And I call these materials, humanos, and spiritus.
Materials,
humanos, and spiritus. Essentially, you got to have your material needs in terms of food, shelter, and so on satisfied. And you've got to have your human needs, which is for societal interaction.
Yes, real connection.
Real connection.
Ghanaian style.
Yep.
Ghanaian style.
Yep. And then the spirit, your spirituality, your connection with God.
Yeah.
And if you got these in balance, then that's when you as a human really are fulfilling your full potential and your identity as a child of God. But when you have one out of balance, say you focus on materials and it's all about material wealth and benefits and so on and so forth without the other side, then you get out of kilter.
Yeah. When have you been most balanced of those human, material, and spiritual domains in your life, do you think?
I think it's been a constant quest. I think probably right about now, because I've gone from an egocentric type person where it was all about me, I need to get on, to coming to the realization that it's not all about me. It's really all about us. So we should be thinking about we and us and applying the golden rule as a core tenet.
Dr. Bencole calls it the platinum rule. Don't treat people like you want to be treated. Treat them like they wish to be treated. Taking it to a new level.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Yes, my guest last week, Ali Al-Mashakil, said it's only been 100 years that we've had passports. And I really, that struck me. I mean, of course they didn't have passports in the way olden days. But we really are one people moving about the earth.
Precisely. What do you think about it? It's just one planet Earth.
It's just what?
One planet Earth.
Oh, yes, yes.
That we live on, yeah. And the whole of the cosmos where we have this singular planet that we all live on.
Yes, and there are canaries, and there are alligators, and there are monkeys, and there are humans, right? Not all different kinds of humans, just plain old humans.
Precisely.
We are all wanting the same things. So you've experienced the world in ways most people don't ever get a chance to see. I think even travelers rarely make it to 23 countries. I think that gives you a special vantage point to notice these things in balance for people. Have you been to a specific culture where you feel that they've balanced the material, human, and spiritual domains especially well as a group?
I think to me it's actually a work in progress across the world, because when I look at it in sort of generalization, I know you can't generalize, because everyone is an individual and but as a general rule, I see that the Western culture is what I call a material centric culture, and it's gone on with technological developments and so on and some material things. The African culture I see as a humanos-centric culture. East Asia I see as a spiritus culture that's moving towards a materials culture, and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, I see it kind of like a bar graph where we all have all three, but sometimes have a bigger one in one section, a smaller one.
You've got it right. Exactly.
I got it right. The professor says. You worked with people of many backgrounds, and you said something that interested me. You said a lot of people's notions about people of other cultures can be addressed through social interventions like Peace Corps and exchange programs rather than war and fisticuffs. You didn't say fisticuffs. Mm. Can you say more about that? What do you want people to see and know about one another?
I think first and foremost, I've come to the realization that to me, the most powerful thing in the world is thought, the power of the mind, because everything that exists starts with a thought. And thought is essentially the blueprint to things manifesting. When you look at, for example, the Bible, it says that be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, and thought are things. There's a book by James Allen called As a Man Thinketh, which has been one of the things that shaped my thinking. And the truth really, as I found it, is that we are all children, or what I call outcroppings of one God. And when one hurts, we all hurt.
Like your brothers.
And that is simply because of the interconnectedness of everything in the universe. We all live on one planet, Mother Earth. The sense of separateness is an illusion, and our challenge in growth and development as a human race is conquering our egos, the me, mine, I, which gives us a sense of separateness. When we look at, say, the Lord's Prayer as an example, it does not say my Father or his Father, but our Father.
Hmm.
And so for me, the fundamental tenets of all the major world religions is the golden rule. Love God above all else. Love your neighbor as yourself. And what I found out is that when you apply these as a model for living, it works. If I treat you the way you want to be treated and I respect you, you respond accordingly. Even on a corporate level, for example, when you take either corporate or country level, if my department respects your department and we all put the corporate interest as the overriding interest, things work. If in the neighborhood, I put your interest the same level as my interest and we all cooperate, everything works well. But it's when we don't cooperate and that we take individual interest above everything else that you get problems. Even on the human being, just another analogy in terms of cancer cells, for example. Cancer cells are cells that are not programmed to die. So they are selfish cells. They want to continue living, and they end up killing the superorganism that's a human being. But if they apply the principle of, let me cooperate, and it's my turn to die, and, you know, then that way, you know,
a body can be sustained.
Yeah, precisely.
So it really comes down to love thy neighbor.
Yes.
For you. I'm surprised by how a smile and a wave can melt people, can melt preconceived notions, and are just the signal from one animal to the other. That's how
right.
we signal each other that we are
yes.
non-threatening.
But the smile has to be a genuine smile.
Yes.
It makes a difference whether the smile is it's from the heart
mm-hmm.
or not.
And the eyes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What's your dream, Bob? You see yourself in 5 to 10 years doing what? What would be the best use of all this wisdom you've gathered throughout your lifetime? What might manifest in the next years?
Well, essentially, I put it down to one word, which I call mentoring. But in essence, I know that God put in me the passion for water for a reason. And where I want to be is to be able to impact the majority of the peoples on the planet who don't have access to clean water and sanitation. And I'm looking at ways in which I can help through education efforts and through outreach and training and also developing technologies that help address these challenges.
Do you know what you just said? You want to bring three things: humanity, spirituality.
I didn't even think about it.
And material. That's your plan for the coming 5 to 10 years. That is so beautiful.
I hadn't thought about it in that sort of sense. Wow.
Bob, you are an understated yet powerful individual from a large family and a powerful family serving multiple communities on 3 different continents. Your mother, who's approaching 90, is surely very proud of you, and I am impressed by her, too. Thank you for working so tirelessly to learn and teach on the subject of clean and accessible water for all. What could be more important than that? And thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much, Kate. It's been an honor and a pleasure to be with you here today.
And thank you all for listening. Please join us each week for similar interviews with diverse members of our community. If you would like to hear this complete interview or interviews from previous weeks, please visit newmainerspeak.com and check out more related information at facebook.com/newmainerspeak. I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest Bob Ando. Bob, would you introduce the song we're going to close with today?
I think I'd like us to close with One Love by Bob Marley.
And why did you pick that song?
Because everything boils down to love.
Right on. Here we go.
Together to fight is only I'm a Gideon.